if there seem to be fewer people than normal, there are a couple of explanations for that. One is there's a big event up at DeBenneville where about 22 or 24 of our kids are up and working and creating a legacy for the future at DeBenneville. And the other is conceivably my entry into the great sweepstakes of how to come up with the most hideously inappropriate Mother's Day sermon title possible. And you'll note that my winning entry in the Fullerton Observer on page 16 was May 10th, End of Life Hard Choices. I wasn't looking at the calendar when I came up with that. I had no idea that that was going to be Mother's Day, but it makes me a winner in the sweepstakes, at least this year. I had a friend and colleague, because mine at least was inefficient and inept and a mistake, but I had a friend who knowingly chose to do his abortion sermon on Mother's Day. So I think he still wins. And so yesterday morning at when I caught, I said, well, should I change it? It's in the paper. And, you know, I normally don't throw out a sermon unless there's some pressing hot new issue that happens in the world. But in a weak moment, having flown all night long and slept about an hour and a half, Judy called yesterday at 7 a.m. and said, is this a joke? Is this your just kind of perverse sense of humor? And I said, I don't know. And, do you want to change the title? Sure, M is for the many things she gave me. Good night, Judy. At which point, my granddaughters, Roxy and Iris, came bounding into the bed, and you only cost me about 3.5 minutes. So it's not a problem. Mother's Day is always a challenge. Because either you go to something hideously inappropriate in order to get a new view of it, or you do one of those saccharine things about mom and or the super sweet, which puts the vulnerable diabetic population at risk, or you do the angry, look how they've ruined Mother's Day. Julia Ward Howe had such a great radical idea. And there's nothing that we basically can't commercialize and co-opt and corrupt, all of which is true. All of which is true. But Mother's Day is about something. It really is about our human need and our vulnerability. It's impossible to talk about the issues of love and of giving our hearts, whether as parents or as children or grandparents or grandchildren, nieces, nephews, families, without that issue of mortality creeping in. Because it is part of the mystery of love is related to the preciousness of life, and the preciousness of life and the precious nature of love are related to our human vulnerability, our willingness to open up our arms, to take off some of the armor, and to have our beating hearts exposed, to be held, to be touched, to be scarred, and to be broken. The vulnerability of human beings is really at the living heart of the deeper meaning of mothering, of fathering, and of parenting. This, to me, is a holiday and should really be a holy day where we look at those things, those people, those miracles that we tend to take for granted. And really what Julia Ward Howe was doing was saying to American women and men in the 19th century, "What? Stop! Look! Look at what women are doing in the world, and look at what women are contributing to the world, and look at how the world doesn't see it, doesn't appreciate it, doesn't acknowledge it, just takes it for granted." Of course, this is what a woman does. This is what a mother does. And Julia Ward Howe was really saying, come on, look. Look at the love that is given, not commanded. Look at the vulnerability of the heart that is offered, because when you look at a small child as a grown-up, you see the vulnerability. You see how precious it is. And as human beings, we see a very long period of vulnerability when our children need us. And we need to be emotionally connected to them. As Doug Adams said, an amoeba really is all it can be the moment that it separates and becomes two amoebae. Even when you have some exchange of genetic information, which is highfalutin talk for sex, two paramecium, once they conjugate, the next paramecia is pretty much all he, she can be. But our children do not stand up immediately. They do not forage for food. They don't know how, well, they have a swimming instinct, but they are not water safe at birth. They can't feed themselves. They have a very long period when they need us. Their biological parents, their non-biological parents, and all the people who love and sustain them. And it's built into our code, and sometimes we override that code, that parenting, that being a mother and a father, being a part of a family, is putting something else and someone else in a position at least equal to our own wills and desires and impulses, and often above our own immediate self-interest. The comic monologue is absolutely true. We don't understand parenting and what our parents did until we become parents. And that may be karma, it may be the best revenge, or it may just be an opening of our minds and hearts. I didn't fully appreciate my mother until I became a parent. And I walked the midnight hall with my crying baby and feeling my crying baby's fevered brow and praying sincerely, if not with great sense of confidence in the efficacy of the prayer, still sincerely, because I don't know parents who don't say, it would be easier for me to have the fever, to have the cold, to have the flu, to be in the hospital than for me to watch feeling helplessly as it is my child. That is the remarkable gift that human beings have, to be able to see someone else, some other people, as more important than ourselves. And it's a gift to give up the kind of egocentric worldview, which is the human version of the heliocentric worldview, where each of us is not the center of the universe, but we are sources to others in our family, however we understand family. Family can be one woman, family can be one man. It can be two men, it can be two women, it can even, I know this will shock you, be a man and a woman. There are all different combinations of how we understand family. And in our society, I hope, a growing appreciation of how we understand family and just what we mean to each other. It's important to take into consideration the issues of vulnerability and mortality. If we were immortal, why get up? Why love? Why take a chance? Why risk? Today just isn't any more important than tomorrow. If we were invulnerable, if we were Superman with no kryptonite, if we were Wolverine and nothing could destroy us, we'd wonder why there were three pictures and where the peril was. But if there's no peril, there's no vulnerability, how do we give our hearts? In economics, we understand, today more than ever, that value is related to scarcity. And if our days were numberless, I don't know what value an individual day would be. If we did not worry about each other and care about each other and have to take care of each other, what would the nature of our hearts be if they were never opened and never given? If the universe were filled, if our streets were literally paved with gold and diamonds, gold and diamonds would have no value because they had no scarcity. For people who want to argue it's intrinsic, I give you zircons and iron pyrite. They're just as pretty, but they're not as scarce. It is the fact that we number our days that we should get ourselves hearts of the wisdom to learn how to love one another. This is a lesson that was so driven home to me this week when my cousin Sam, my wife's cousin Sam, called up 2 days after his 60th birthday, and we'd given him a birthday party, and told me that his dad had died, Vic, at age just 2 weeks short of 93. And it certainly wasn't a surprise, but it's still a shock. One of the great pieces of wisdom of the world is you cannot prepay grief. You can think you're ready, but you cannot prepay it. When it hits, there is still the shock. There is still the loss. And Vic had asked for me to do his service. And I was greatly honored by that. I didn't feel that honored in the economy class at 1 o'clock in the morning, but that's another story of my own personal issues. But he was the patriarch of the clan. And he was the patriarch of the clan, not simply by dint of having reached a ripe old age of 93.95. He was the patriarch because it was a large family. And as a large family, it wasn't completely a unified family. I'm not going to sell the idea that family or community or mothers or fathers are all perfect and we should sentimentalize them. It was a wide and raucous family where there were some members of the family who would shout at each other, which I completely understand. There were other members of the family that just weren't talking to each other, which I don't get at all. Shouting, throwing, I get. Not talking, I don't get. And one of the reasons, and that's one of the main reasons I'm telling the story, that Vic was the center of the family, is he still spoke to everyone in the large extended family. It was somebody else's business if Fred wasn't talking to Ethel and Greta wasn't talking to Mary. He talked to everyone, and what other people's issues were, that was up to them. He thought that the most important thing in his life was family. And he made only two requests for his memorial service, or actually funeral. One was that I do it, and the other that I tell the story about how he got a full scholarship to the University of Chicago, and when he graduated, he was offered a full scholarship to McGill to get a PhD. And his father called and said, you know, your brother Sam is in the Army, it was World War II, and I need you at the factory. And he gave up the PhD program, and his view, his entire life was, I didn't give it up. I chose family, and it made all the difference. That was the crossroads when I chose between abstraction and my family, and being with them and working with them and being at the center of all of it. And that's the kind of attitude that earned him the sense that we all had that he was the patriarch of the family. I think there's an important lesson in this for every family, for every relationship, for every community. It's easy to be sentimental, and it's easy to be cynical. It's harder to live in the hurly-burly of relationship and notice each other and see what each person gives and contributes and how they touch our lives and can touch our hearts if we will be vulnerable enough to open up our hearts to be touched. to be hurt, to be scarred, to be broken, and to be filled with love. Choosing family and the preciousness and vulnerability. Well, I'm going to segue into a little bit into my announced topic. My granddaughter Roxy, who's 5 years old, should be leaving the house about now to go to her great-grandmother Margaret's 90th birthday party on Mother's Day. That's why my son and daughter-in-law and two granddaughters flew in from the north. And Roxy at 5 said, "How much longer is Grandma Munger going to be alive?" And I know I shouldn't ask that. And I said, you should ask whatever you're thinking, whatever you're wondering. You should ask and you should care about that. Now, I was surprised by the question because, according to all the books, she's not supposed to kind of get that concept for another 2 years. No, I'm not bragging. I think a lot of it has to do with media and other sorts of things. But she has the beginning of a sense of the vulnerability of the older generation. And it's an interesting phenomenon that happens. When we are parents, we are very worried about the vulnerability of our precious children. They run, they fall down, that first boo-boo, and that's a technical term, that first boo-boo that you have to kiss, you have to wash, you have to anesthetize, you have to do all of the antibacterial, antifungal, and general hysteria sorts of things until by the 17th boo-boo it's take care of yourself, kid. Then we grow up a little older, and then we see our parents, and we see their vulnerability. They move from being supermen and superwomen who will be here forever with their strength and with their wisdom and just their presence. And then we see them become more vulnerable. And we know that when they fall, it is not necessarily a boo-boo that gets healed by a kiss. But the kiss, whether physical or emotional or verbal, still counts. The presence to each other, as parents to children, and as children to parents and to grandparents, still counts. The gift, and this is a paragraph, a sentence that you will hear from me in some form every Mother's Day, every Father's Day, every Christmas, every Hanukkah, is this. The only present of value is our presence, is the here I am caring about you, reaching out to you, me in my imperfection, you in your imperfection, with all of the history, we are talking, we are present, we are loving, and we appreciate the gift of time and of vulnerability that we give to each other, because that's what makes our hearts human. That's what makes us more fully alive. So at Mother's Day, I think we celebrate family. We celebrate generosity of spirit. We celebrate the forgiveness that we offer to parents who were not perfect, in the hope that that fine example will be an inspiration to our children to forgive parents who are not perfect. And we work on celebrating the love and the madness and the passion and the worry that brought us to this moment where we can give and share and be together in family, however we understand it. One person, two people, a community, a vulnerability, a sense of connection where our hearts are connected and there is something for moments that is greater than ourselves. A look in the eye, the feeling of an embrace, a word of love, of acceptance, a sense of connection to something greater. And that's why I don't go on the rant about the commercialization. I I think it's a wonderful day to be together and to share. I'm going to share a story, and I'm going to invite, instead of the normal talk back, it'll be an abnormal talk back, and ask you to share briefly a story about a parent, either your own or something that happened with your child. And I guess my favorite story about my mother that I can tell in this room, my actual favorite story I can't tell, it was just one of those horrifying moments where she spoke the truth in front of strangers. But the one that I can tell is I came to the apartment, and there are cliches in the world, and they're often based on something. And so the Jewish mother cliche played out exactly like this. Sweetheart, you've gained a little weight. Sit down. I went to Vicente Foods, and I got apples. I went to Whole Foods. I got pears. What would you like? I took a pear. She said, you don't like the apple?